Welcome to Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Satalia. Have attitudes about race and inequality changed for the better? We'll ask our guest William Darity Jr., the Samuel Du Bois Cook Professor of Public Policy, African and African American Studies, and Economics at Duke University. He's also the founding director of the Research Network on Racial and Ethnic Inequality at Duke, and served as director of graduate studies at the University of North Carolina. His research focuses on racial, ethnic, and economic inequalities. WPSU's Kate Lau Schaffner talks with him about how structural racial inequalities persist in post-Obama America. We'll also hear about his ideas for policy solutions to address inequalities across race and socioeconomic class. William Darity, thank you so much for joining us. You've said the United States is characterized by a pattern of structural racial inequality, and you've done the research to prove it. Can you give us a picture of how this is true today?
Yeah. So when I talk about structural inequalities, I'm not talking about interpersonal relationships. I'm not talking about person A calling person B a bad name. I'm talking about a set of processes that exist in the society on a day-to-day basis that perpetuate disparities between groups of people or between individuals that are not anchored in anything that we would construe as being fair or equitable.
I've seen your talks, and you mentioned some really disheartening statistics, like the black unemployment rate has consistently been twice as high as the white unemployment rate for the past 50 years.
Yes.
And you're saying actually these disparities are deepened further as a result of economic downturn.
Yes, but also there's some disturbing paradoxes. The unemployment rate for blacks who have some college education is higher than the unemployment rate for whites who have not completed high school. Another paradox is the fact that blacks who have no criminal record are less likely to get a callback for jobs than whites who do. So I think that these are illustrations of the structural factors that I'm talking about that represent persistence and discrimination. So apart from the adverse effects of the recession, we still have these deep disparities that are associated with differential treatment of people with similar qualifications. And the recession has only made matters worse because typically blacks were the first to be unemployed in the process of collapsing job opportunities in this economy. The classic aphorism, which is a tragic one, is first fired, last hired. And that's regardless of an individual's credentials or previous training.
You've proposed some very interesting programs, such as a federal job creation program, as well as something you call baby bonds. Can you tell us about these? First, maybe the federal job creation program, which you call National Investment Employment Corps.
Yeah. So the former is a policy proposal to try to address unemployment differentials as well as generally high unemployment for everyone. The latter is a policy that is intended to address differences in wealth or inequalities in wealth. So the former is a proposal that the federal government would bear direct responsibility for ensuring that all Americans have access to a job. And the jobs would be provided through the National Investment Employment Corps, which would be a body that would actually guarantee a job for everyone. So anyone who's seeking work could find it through the public sector, through this agency. The idea is very, very similar to what was done in the 1930s with the Works Progress Administration and the Civilian Conservation Corps. And that is, the federal government took direct responsibility for providing employment for thousands of Americans who were out of work. So it's a similar idea, except it would be universally applicable. Anybody who wanted a public sector job could get one, and it would be permanent rather than temporarily applied during the course of the crisis. another important dimension of this policy that I should mention is that it would provide employment at non-poverty wages.
And you said, for example, your starting salary, your minimum salary would be $23,000 a year.
Yeah, and that would be there would also be, in addition to that, a benefits package. And if we were to take into account that cost with the expenses that might be associated with the training program, as well as whatever materials and supplies the individuals who are employed in these activities would have to utilize, I estimated that roughly the cost per person would be about $50,000. And then I did a back of the envelope calculation that if you put 15 million people to work, and 15 million is the number of persons who are unemployed at the trough of the current recession. If you put 15 million people to work at $50,000 per person, it would cost you about $750 billion. Simultaneously, in 2011, our anti-poverty budget was in the vicinity of about $740 billion. So you could substantially reduce that while you're expanding or increasing the scope of the federal job guarantee program. And your net cost would not be that significant.
And you're saying this is an investment.
Yeah, in two ways. It's an investment in preserving individuals' incomes, their sanity, because we do know that being out of work places a heavy burden on people's mental health. But we also could use this program to repair and expand the nation's physical and human infrastructure. And this would be a substantial investment. And that's why the title of this program has investment in the name.
And by that, you mean the types of jobs that you create would be, you know, fixing bridges, or you even mentioned high-quality childcare.
Childcare, yeah. So there's a number of ways in which you could be enhancing the physical system of travel and transportation in the society, as well as benefiting people individually in terms of their own human capital development.
And now baby bonds.
Okay, so that's a somewhat different program. Baby bonds is motivated by the recognition that there are high degrees of wealth inequality in the United States. And the degree of wealth inequality in America is probably far, far greater than the degree of income inequality. I've seen figures that suggest that the top 1% of the wealth distribution in this country owns in excess of 35 to 40% of all of the assets in this country. So then if we look at racial wealth differences, those are also quite dramatic. But I tried to think in conjunction with a colleague of mine named Derek Hamilton, who's at the New School, tried to think about a way in which you could design a program that would address wealth inequality in general while simultaneously reducing the wealth disparities by race. And so we thought that it would be a good idea to have a program where you provided each newborn infant with the equivalent of an endowment or a trust fund from the federal government. And the magnitude of this fund would be contingent upon the wealth of the child's family. So if a family is extremely wealthy, then we would give the child a very small endowment.
The example, like a token amount.
Yeah, the example I like to use is if by chance Oprah Winfrey or Bill Gates had an additional child, then we'd give that newborn infant a $50 trust fund. But if a child is born into a family at the opposite end of the wealth distribution, say the lowest quintile, the allocation could be as high as $50,000 to $60,000. And each child would have access to this fund when they reach adulthood. Given the way in which voting is designated now, it'd be 18 years of age. If people were concerned about the kids frivolously spending this money, we could always place restrictions on what it could be used for. So it might be restricted to being used in part for purposes of financing higher education or so on. But the idea is to say that wealth disparities that exist are not a consequence of merit, and they certainly shouldn't be transferred to the next generation without any form of an intervention to give more and more kids a fairer chance to participate in the society.
I've heard you say that, you know, there's a lot of talk about, you know, educating children will help them come out of poverty, but you're saying that family wealth, or even, you know, having parents who are able to help you out when you're in a jam, that actually has a huge impact.
Yeah, my snarky line is, rich people may have dumb children, but they never have poor children. Or the other way to think about this is, I was at a conference once and somebody said to me, you know, the problem with you, Darity, is you think there are too many rich people. And I responded by saying, no, I don't think there's enough. And I think what we want to do is to give more people more resources to make it feasible for them to be full participants in our society.
So I'm curious, where do your ideas stand politically? So I imagine, for example, those who are in opposition towards the Affordable Care Act would say, how could you trust the government to take on such huge projects? Are these ideas you're actively lobbying for? Are these just ideas to start a national conversation?
No, I'm actively lobbying for them. I think at the moment, oddly enough, there may be a bit more gravitas granted to the job guarantee proposal, or more attention being given to it than is being given to the baby bonds proposal. Although there's a substantial precedent for the baby bonds proposal in the UK, where they had a child trust fund policy that lasted for about a decade. But in the U.S., Congressman John Conyers now has a bill that he's developing, which would essentially provide a job guarantee for all Americans. And it's predicated on the much earlier Humphrey Hawkins Act, which essentially said that if the private sector doesn't generate enough employment to provide full employment for all Americans, then the government is responsible for providing those additional jobs. And so the Humphrey Hawkins Act functioned somewhat like what we might call an unfunded mandate. So you have a policy that you're supposed to pursue, but there's no specifics about how to do it. And so what Conyers is attempting to do is introduce a bill that would provide specifics about how to meet this obligation or this responsibility. I'm not sure what the reaction would be of people who are against the Affordable Care Act per se, because the idea here is to pay people for working. Okay. And I would think that many of the folks who might be uncomfortable about the Affordable Care Act would prefer paying people to work rather than just giving them money gratis. In addition, apparently there was a survey that was taken by the Huffington Post maybe about 2 months ago that MSNBC reported on, and they provided a report in mid-January. And it found that not a majority, but a plurality of Americans are in favor of a job guarantee, 47%. So I think that, you know, if this became something that really got substantial public attention, there is a momentum to support it.
What do you think about President Obama's push to raise the minimum wage?
Well, you know, I'm not against that, but I think that the job guarantee provides a way to address the problem of low wages. So you raise the minimum wage. I'm not sure how much is proposed at this point. Is it to place it slightly over $10 an hour? That's still a poverty wage rate. But by having a federal job guarantee in which you ensured that the floor on the least paid job in the federal job guarantee program was above the poverty line, you also would compel the private sector to provide employment on at least those conditions or terms. So it would function as a minimum wage, but it would also function as a minimum wage that is above the poverty line. So essentially what you do with the federal job guarantee is you establish a minimum standard of compensation for all workers. And I think that that's a far more effective device than incrementally raising the minimum wage every 4 or 5 years, and then having this raging debate over whether you're going to throw people who are out of work already out of work as a consequence of raising the minimum wage.
You said something like the public sector would function as an employer of last resort. So yes. The idea is no one would have to be unemployed.
No one would have to be unemployed under this proposal. In fact, if you saw somebody who was out of work in a world where you had the federal job guarantee, then they would truly be choosing to be out of work. And if you're out of work and you're not looking for work, then we don't count you as unemployed. And so this is a direct route to full employment.
If you're just joining us, this is Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Satalia. Our guest is William Darity Jr., a professor of public policy, African and African American studies, and economics at Duke University. He's talking with WPSU's Kate Lau Schaffner about affirmative action in the United States and around the world.
You've spoken up, changing gears a little bit.
Sure.
You've spoken up in favor of affirmative action. Since its implementation in the early 1960s, keeping in mind the persistence of income disparities, has it worked? And is there evidence it's worked to change the deeper issues of racism?
Affirmative action is not a mechanism for eliminating racism. It's not a mechanism for addressing income inequality, per se. It's a mechanism for controlling and contravening discrimination. And it also is a mechanism for desegregating elites. So if the positions that people from a stigmatized group are most likely to be excluded from are the most preferred positions, then if you can apply affirmative action effectively, then you can introduce them into those positions. The question is whether or not you can apply affirmative action effectively without people's attitudes already changing. And I think that that's the tricky issue, because people will subvert affirmative action programs if they are not convinced that they are the right thing to do. On the other hand, if there are ways to enforce it despite what people believe, then you don't have to worry about changing attitudes, per se. I think affirmative action is useful because it's a tool in the anti-discrimination arsenal. And I think it's one that can be used effectively if it's implemented with force. One of the problems we face in the United States is it's not typically implemented with a great deal of force. That raises questions about the enforcement process. And that's what we really have to address in making affirmative action more effective. The other issue is, of course, the fact that the court system continuously limits the scope of affirmative action in the United States. And I've been inclined to look at other countries to try to identify more effective implementation of affirmative action. And so I think it's worthwhile to study, in particular, the experiences of India, Brazil, and Malaysia, both the positive and negative dimensions of their experiences, to figure out how to better implement affirmative action in the U.S. And in fact, India has had an affirmative action program on behalf of the untouchables and the tribals since the adoption of the first post-independence Indian constitution in 1948. So India has a much longer history of experience with affirmative action. But when affirmative action was first seriously considered in the United States, no one bothered to look at the Indian experience to try to inform us about how best to do it. And I think we still need to look at other countries' experiences to better inform us about how to implement affirmative action effectively.
So, yeah, tell me some of the lessons that the U.S. can learn.
So in India, for example, affirmative action is explicitly based on a quota system. So the percentage of positions that are set aside for Dalits and tribals are predicated on estimates of their presence in the general Indian population. So I think if you combine Dalits and tribals, this means 22 or 23% of positions in the civil service, or positions in positions as students in colleges and universities that receive governmental monies must be, in quotes, in their language, reserved for Dalits and tribals. The Dalits are the people who we would traditionally think of as the untouchables, and the tribals are folks who are disproportionately concentrated in parts of North India, who are not actually part of the Hindu religious faith, but are in a very systematically and consistently deprived condition. In fact, some people would argue that the conditions that confront the average tribal might be worse than the conditions that confront the average untouchable. But, you know, we're talking about both communities of people who are subjected to a high degree of deprivation. But they use a quota system, an explicit quota system. And I think, you know, in the U.S., there's been a tendency to be very averse towards the use of explicit quotas. And instead, we use a system that we might refer to as one of preferential boost, primarily, sort of adding on points for somebody who is seeking a position who is from one of the targeted groups. And I think it would be very, very useful to explore whether or not the explicit quota system is more effective. And I should add that the quota system does require the individuals to meet certain qualification standards. So it's not like you erase any kind of qualification standard at all, but you give priority to the individuals who meet that qualification standard by holding seats aside that only they can fill. The other thing in India is there's a political dimension to their affirmative action program. The parliamentary seats, both at the federal and the state level, a certain proportion of them are set aside that can only be held by Dalits or tribals, again, based upon the proportion rules. And there's been some interesting evidence exploring whether or not this has had a beneficial effect for the Dalit and tribal communities. I think the consensus is on net, yes, it has. And I think by looking at the Indian experience, again, the pros and cons, we might have a richer sense of what types of ways we might modify our voting rules and voting procedures in the U.S. to be more inclusive.
Just anecdotally, I've heard people talk about affirmative action as, oh, well, they picked you because of your race, or they didn't pick you because you're a white male and you're overrepresented. But the bottom line is it's the current system doesn't choose people by merit. So the whole idea is leveling the playing field.
Excellent point. So the premise behind that complaint is that if you didn't have affirmative action, everybody would be selected on a merit basis. That's probably not the case anywhere in any part of the world. I mean, especially if you look at the evidence in India, in the absence of the affirmative action program, certainly not the case that one could claim that the kids who gained entry into colleges and universities only did so on the basis of their merit, per se. And that's not the case in the U.S. either. We can recognize the fact that we have certain kinds of preferential boost for other candidates who are applicants for colleges and universities. I mean, implicitly, there's a preferential boost for high-caliber athletes, regardless of the sport. There's a preferential boost for people who might have special talents, like they might be talented visual artists, not have very good grades. They might be musicians and not have outstanding grades, but they might be accepted into a conservatory program within a larger university. We also have preferential boosts for folks whose parents or grandparents or uncles or aunts attended the institution previously. We call these legacies. So there's a variety of ways in which we actually do privilege folks by giving them preferential boosts that are not linked to race at all, not linked to ethnicity. But if we're thinking that, you know, realistically there's segments of our population who would not get into these institutions, not because they are lousy students, but simply because the decks are stacked against them on racial grounds, affirmative action becomes a mechanism of trying to make that process more equal.
And I'm sure our listeners are familiar with studies where, you know, all else being equal, race or sex sways of
sways the outcome. And I'll add, you know, it's interesting. We do observe educational disparities. That is to say, on average, blacks have less educational attainment than whites. But if you were to control for family background, the socioeconomic status that the individual black or white person comes from, blacks actually get more years of schooling and more credentials than whites. So if you adjust for socioeconomic status, you actually get the reverse outcome from what most people imagine is the case.
One of the things you've talked about and you're talking about is the persistence of discrimination in, quote, post-racial America.
I mean, I think that the actor Will Smith said something to the effect after Obama's election, there are no more excuses now. And so essentially he was saying that the playing field is level, that, you know, there's no obstacles to black success except whatever are the limitations of our own actions. And I think that that's entirely incorrect. I mean, the evidence on discrimination and employment is really, really telling about the continuity of conditions where there is a penalty associated with being black. And the Obama election doesn't reverse that. And interestingly enough, Obama's own silence about these sorts of issues has made it impossible for his presidency to have much of an effect on these conditions. Some people might argue that things might be worse in 2014 than they were in 2008, particularly since we've had to undergo the adverse effects of the most crushing economic downturn since the Great Depression.
So you've been a college professor since 1983. Have you become more or less optimistic about issues of race as you've dealt with college students over the years? So we're talking, you know, we're talking about economics, and obviously there are a lot of really disheartening statistics out there. But in terms of attitudes, do you feel that things are changing for the better?
No, but I don't necessarily think attitudes are worse. I don't, you know, this may be a very strange thing to say after, well, it's a long time. So it's essentially, I've been a college professor for a little more than 30 years, I guess. It may be a very strange thing to say, but I don't really see any significant difference in the attitudes that the average college student that I encounter has versus, today versus the average college student I first encountered when I started in 1983.
Yeah. Wow.
So... I don't know that – certainly that's not an optimistic response, but then again, I guess it's not a pessimistic response. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for joining us.
Okay. Thank you for having me.
That was WPSU's Kate Lau Schaffner talking with William Darity Jr. He's a professor at Duke University. He's the editor-in-chief of the International Encyclopedia of the Social Sciences and the associate editor of the Encyclopedia of Race and Racism. He's published or edited 13 books and published more than 200 articles in professional journals. To learn more, check the links on our website, radio.wpsu.org. I'm Patty Satalia, WPSU.